Je voudrais remercier encore une fois professeur Jean Nicheit qui a eu la gentillesse de m'inviter. C'est vraiment un grand plaisir d'être ici, de pouvoir passer une semaine à Paris et puis avoir l'occasion de présenter mon travail ici. With that, I will change language into English because tonight's lecture will be presented in English. So the image has nothing to do with Boileau. I just wanted us to have some inspiration because we're moving to Hades now. So in 1664, Nicolas Boileau, French poet and novel-hating critic, as we heard the other day, composed a satire entitled Les héros de roman, dialogue à la manière de Lucien. The dialogue is set in Hades, where Pluto, king of the underworld, worries about an impending revolt of the criminals of Tartarus. He calls upon the dead heroes of the Elysian fields, asking for their protection. Diogenes the Cynic, the inscribed satirist of the dialogue, warns Pluto, saying that these heroes are just une troupe de fous, a group of madmen more interested in dancing than in going to war. But Pluto still calls the heroes to appear before himself and King Minos, one of the judges of the underworld, and so they come forward one by one, and they turn out to be heroes and heroines of French 17th century novels. They also appear as rather unheroic because the only thing they talk about is love. They are thus exposed as imposters, impersonating real heroes, and are therefore whipped and thrown into Lethe, river of oblivion. The troublesome situation of the underworld that is described in this dialogue, Hades having become a place filled with people who talk about gallantry and love, all this is of course a reflection of the problems that Boileau saw in Paris of his own days. He used the dialogue to ridicule and criticize the novelistic tradition in general, but his main target was Madeleine de Scudéry, one of the most popular novelists of the time. And this was not a one-time thing, because there are several references to her also in his other satires. And Boileau's hostility towards de Scudéry was not only literary, but also personal. She had, in fact, tried to block his election to the Académie Française, which did not go unpunished. But I won't get too involved in 17th century literary politics tonight. I did that the other day. But tonight the focus of my paper is not the context, but the literary form of this piece, namely the dialogue set in Hades. You probably noticed that the title of Boileau's text includes its literary pedigree. It's a dialogue in the manner of Lucien, à la manière de Lucien. Now, even if the catabasis motif in itself, the descent into the underworld, goes back to early Greek mythology and Homer, the journey to Hades and the lengthy conversations that could take place there clearly go back to Lucien's satirical dialogues, dating to the 2nd century AD. And it's well known that Lucien had great influence in Europe, perhaps especially from the 1600s onwards when the first translations began to appear. His texts offered welcome models for parody and satirical tools that could be used by early modern intellectuals, not the least in the debates for and against the novel or for and against the use of ancient literature. Rather than looking in general at the descent to Hades as a fictional motif that allows you to satirize and criticize social and political power, I will focus specifically at Hades as a place where you may encounter authors and intellectuals of the past or the present. That is to say, the underworld as a platform where intellectual, authorial, and fictional issues may be displayed and discussed. And these discussions firmly placed within the frame of fiction may then in turn function as comical, critical, or subversive approaches toward power structures. I will argue that this is a characteristic that you may see not only in the early modern and modern European versions of the katabasis motif, but also in the Greek models of late antiquity and in Byzantium. Lucian's place in the Byzantine tradition has not been investigated in much detail, with some significant exceptions. The highly negative lemma in the Suda, stating that Lucian will inherit with Satan a share of the eternal fire, is often taken as an indication of a general attitude towards Lucian. This seems to be supported by Aretas of Caesarea in the late 9th or early 10th century, staging in his Scholia a fierce attack on Lucian, listing all the names he would have called him had he had a chance to talk to him. And here are just a couple of them. However, Aretas does not just criticize Lucian, he addresses him directly. This is the vocative, right? So he engages in an imaginary dialogue with the ancient author. So in a way, Aretas uses a Lucianic device himself. And other Byzantine authors do not really criticize Lucian. On the contrary, his popularity seems to peak in the 12th century with a keen revival of ancient literature and the clear interest in parody and satire. There are many ways of using Lucianic material in the 12th century and onwards, but I shall focus here on the most well-known example, the anonymously transmitted dialogue, Timarion. This dialogue begins and ends with a talk between the protagonist Timarion and his friend Kidion in Constantinople. Timarion has apparently been away for some time and is greeted by Kidion, who urges him to tell his story. Timarion describes a journey to Thessaloniki, where he attends the festival of Saint Demetrios, but then falls seriously ill. He tries to go back to Constantinople, but he only reaches Thrace before he dies. Or at least it seems so at first. His soul is brought to Hades by two shadowy and dusty-looking creatures, and he arrives at the gates of Hades. It first seems to be the Hades we know from the ancient tradition. Even the terrifying dog Kerberos is there, guarding the iron gates. But then again, Kerberos is wagging his tail, rubbing himself against the gods. So something seems to be not quite right here. And this impression is strengthened as we enter the gates, because inside we find a curious mixture of pagan and Christian elements, ancient and Byzantine characters, Diogenes the Cynic, but also Diogenes of Cappadocia, that is the blinded emperor Romanos IV Diogenes. Among many others, Timarion meets his old teacher, Theodore of Smyrna, a rhetorician and teacher in Constantinople who supposedly had died quite recently. For a while, everything seems hunky-dory in this rather nice hell, but then a problem arises. Timarion does not seem to be quite dead. Theodore helps him to make a complaint against the two creatures who seem to have taken him before his time. Asclepius and Hippocrates are called in to consider the matter for 3 days. And then there is a trial at the end of which a forensic inspection of the soul is undertaken. It is decided that Timarion has to return to life. He goes back to his body, still lying in bed in Thrace, and then returns to Constantinople. The dialogue closes as Timarion and Kidion end their conversation by saying goodnight to one another. Based on this brief description of the content, we may note that the Timarion builds on at least 3 narrative traditions that have been combined. First, the Platonic philosophical dialogue, here in the so-called monologic form, where the main narrative is told by one person. Second, the katabasis motif, first used in Homer, book 11 of the Odyssey. And third, the Lucianic satirical dialogue, especially the ones set in Hades, the dialogues with the dead. There's nothing strange about such a mixture of forms in 12th century Byzantium. It fits very well with contemporary attitudes to ancient material. So on the level of composition, this is a completely normal text. On the level of content, it has, however, puzzled readers and scholars because the dialogue is clearly satirical. In fact, it makes fun of pretty much everything that was important in Byzantium: the church, philosophy and rhetoric, medicine and law. The most serious criticism of Byzantine society in the Timareon is probably the way in which Christianity appears. Pagans and Christians live together in the underworld, where freedom of religion seems to reign, and quite a few Christians find themselves in a subordinate position. The majority of judges, for instance, are pagan. The only Byzantine judge is Emperor Theophilus, who was known to be righteous, but who was also an iconoclast and accordingly a heretic. Since we have a Byzantine witness, Konstantinos Akropolitis, writing in the late 13th century, condemning the Timareon as ungodly and anti-Christian, it has often been assumed that the text was seen as problematic in Byzantium. The anonymity of the author and the survival of the text in only one manuscript have been used as a way of supporting that idea. This view of the Timareon as an anti-Christian manifesto was recently picked up and developed by Anthony Caldelis, actually at a conference held here in Paris a few years ago. Caldelis argues that the text supports the appearance of pagan strands of philosophy in 12th century Constantinople. I will return to this question, but let us just note here that we are dealing with one Byzantine reaction to the Timareon. And Akropolitis, a very pious writer of hagiography and theology, was a man of his own time and not of the 12th century. While the first part of the Palaeologan period was marked by severe orthodoxy, in earlier Byzantine periods we may observe a rather open-minded mixture of Christian and pagan elements, along with a certain criticism of the church. Christoforos of Mytilene, for instance, in the early 11th century, wrote pious poems and praised the saints, but at the same time he made fun of monks and relics. This seemingly relaxed attitude to the use of religious elements in literature was rather common in the 12th century, indicated by authors such as Nikiforos Vasilakis and Ptochoprodromos. On a satirical level, the Timareon clearly engages with its contemporary setting, expressing criticism of certain aspects of 12th century society. It is certainly a Comnenian parody or satire, and it has been analyzed as such by Margaret Alexiou and Roderick Beaton. On a textual level, however, the Timareon engages closely with its literary hypertexts, and I therefore think that it's worthwhile looking more carefully at Lucian and his fictional representations of Greek Paideia. Books, learning and authors, especially those that appear in Hades. So let's turn to Lucian and his versions of the visit to the underworld. As you all know, Lucian was writing in the period known as the Second Sophistic, a phase of intense scholarly activity in the Greek-speaking parts of the Roman Empire. Though contemporary sources are silent about Lucian, he must have had at least a moderate success with the satirical dialogue as his speciality. A large number of such dialogues have come down to us, among which about 30 under the heading Dialogues of the Dead. Building on the classical tradition, which was strongly emulated in this period, Lucian picked up the katavasis motif that had appeared, for instance, in Homer and Aristophanes, and had various heroes and gods meet up in Hades for a chat. We have, for example, Hermes and Charon arguing about the payment of the ferry boat that takes dead souls to Hades, or Alexander the Great and Hannibal arguing about who of them is the strongest and the best. In most of these dialogues, the setting of the underworld is taken for granted without being described in any detail. In other texts, Hades as a place and how to get there is thematized to a larger extent. So, for example, in the dialogues known as Kataplus, Menippus, and Charon. In Kataplus, the ferry ride to Hades is described and the conflict between poor and rich is discussed. In Menippus, also known as a necromantic experiment, the protagonist, Menippus the Cynic, describes how he traveled to Hades by means of black magic. And in Charon, the positions are reversed as the Pheromone of Hades travels to the upper world and observes how very strange things are up here. On the level of satire, these dialogues seem to criticize the vanity of human endeavor by displaying the mutability of fortune, supposedly discussed by contemporary sophists and philosophers. The poor man is, in a way, happier than the rich because he has nothing to lose, and in the end, we're all equals, naked in Hades. On a literary level, the author creates a fantasy space which mirrors his own world, but which at the same time allows for criticism of contemporary society. In addition, we shouldn't forget the literary background of the dialogue form. Plato and the philosophical dialogue is certainly hovering behind the scenes. Another important literary figure appears in the dialogue as a character, Menippus, the cynic. Menippus is, of course, the figure behind the term Menippean satire, that is, the kind of satire that Lucian is known for writing, and supposedly his model or master. Menippus thus represents the literary background of the form in which Lucian is excelling. By including Menippus as a character in his dialogues, Lucian has inscribed that authorial tradition into his own text, making it his own. Another such inscription, similar but different, may be found in Lucian's other staging of the underworld, which takes place in the fantasy novel A True Story. This travel tale is known primarily for being the first fiction dealing with outer space and alien life forms, thus being a sort of science fiction. And I guess it is in a way, but it's also a parody of imaginative authors such as Homer and Herodotus, and as such it functions in many ways as a sort of literary criticism. A number of authorial remarks indicating such intentions are included in the introductory section, where, for instance, Odysseus, not Homer, but his narrator, Odysseus, is identified as the instigator of travel fiction. The founder of this school of literary horseplay is Homer's Odysseus, with his stories at Alcinous' courts of winds enslaved and men with one eye and cannibals and wild men of many-headed beasts and how his crew were dragged and transformed. So getting to know these stories, Lucian wanted to make up his own. For I had no true story to relate, since nothing worth mentioning had ever happened to me. But he's different, he claims, from these other literary liars. For I will say one thing that is true, and that is that I'm a liar. My subject, then, is things I have never seen, neither seen nor experienced, nor heard tell of from anybody else. Things, what's more, that do not in fact exist and could not ever exist at all. So my readers must not believe a word I say. These statements are not just a humoristic means of introducing the fantastic story that will follow, but an important comment on literary parody and fictional strategies. And they are relevant to us because the fantastic story of Lucian not only takes us to the moon and back, it also takes us to the place I want to look at here. It takes us to the realms of the dead. Lucian arrives at the Island of the Blessed in Book 2. It turns out to be a wonderful place with plenty of food and wine, poetry and song. At dinner, they give themselves to music and song, Homer's poetry being very popular. Homer himself is there and sits next to Odysseus at a table. So here again, within the fiction, we meet Homer and Odysseus, significantly mentioned already in the introduction. After a few days, the narrator walks up to Homer and asks him some questions. And after that, they sort of become friends. As a matter of fact, I used to do this often afterward, go up and ask questions whenever I saw he wasn't busy. He was very ready to answer, especially after his acquittal in court. Thersites brought libel action against him on the grounds of having been subjected to ridicule in his poetry. Odysseus spoke in Homer's defense and won the case. So literary liars, such as Homer, can win a trial thanks to their fictional characters, at least in another literary lie created by someone like Lucian. The literary tradition on which Lucian is drawing thus becomes integrated in the new work as a meta-literary comment. We may compare this to another well-known comical use of the katabasis motif in Aristophanes, who in his comedy The Frogs has Dionysus travel to Hades in order to bring Euripides back from the dead. And as you remember, in the end, it's Aeschylus who returns to life with Dionysus, since Euripides offers cleverly worded but essentially meaningless advice, whereas Aeschylus provides more practical answers on how Athens can be saved from its present situation. The aim of Aristophanes is probably to ridicule contemporary tragedians by arguing that one of the dead poets has to be brought back to life. In the case of Lucian's visit to the underworld, he makes no attempt to bring Homer back to life, but instead he makes sure that he himself is immortalized by means of an inscription composed by Homer himself and set up as Lucian leaves. Lucian, befriended by the blessed gods, saw this land and returned to his own country. So Lucian thus inscribes himself in the wording and style of Homer in the literary world that he has created as a platform for his own discussion with and parody of the poet. The reason why I spend so much time looking at Lucian is that I want to read the Timarion as a Byzantine adaptation of the Lucianic katabasis. The author adapts it in order to suit his own contemporary purposes, but he keeps some crucial elements related to authorial comments and literary traditions. Knowing Lucian therefore becomes crucial for our understanding of the Timarion. So let's try and approach the Byzantine dialogue from the perspective of literary tradition and intellectual context. We have seen how Lucian used his katabasis narratives not only as a satirical account of contemporary society, but also as a way of voicing literary criticism and staging meetings with dead poets and philosophers. And I think that this is one of the central aspects that the author of the Timarion picks up and adapts in order to voice his own situation as an intellectual in Constantinople. Let us, for instance, consider the meeting between the narrator Timarion and his teacher, Theodore of Smyrna. Theodore was a famous rhetorician who held the prestigious position of consul of philosopher, ipatos ton philosophon, by the end of the 11th century. He was also known for his gluttony, which is ridiculed in the Timarion. After eating himself to death, life in Hades has changed Theodore, and he's now thin and healthy, though longing desperately for the food of the upper world. As has been pointed out by Margaret Alexiou, the portrait of Theodore is funny, but not hostile. It is used in order to comment on a number of contemporary issues of debate, such as the relative merits of Aristotle and Plato, and those of philosophy and rhetoric. In this sense, the Timarion is clearly a philosophical dialogue, not the least in view of its literary form. But philosophy was in some respects hard to distinguish from rhetoric in the 12th century, just as it had been in the 2nd century when Lucian was writing his dialogues. So some comments made in the Timarion concern rather the situation of any intellectual working in court circles of Constantinople, where many writers were writing on commission for imperial or aristocratic circles. "Let me tell you," says Theodore to his former student, "in the life above, it was verbal dexterity and crowd-pleasing wit that counted, sophistia logon and compsotis dimoprepis. Down here, it's all philosophy and true culture, philosophia que pedia sophis, with less demagogic display." I think this comment is crucial because the crowd-pleasing wit that Byzantine writers of the 12th century were forced to come up with is supported by a large number of similar statements in many different contexts. In fact, commenting on your own situation as a writer is almost a leitmotif in Comnenian literature. I'm sure many of you know the famous statement by Ptocho Prodromos, cursing the advice of his father to study grammar and become a learned man. I spit on grammar and I say with tears, Christ done with the letters and with whoever wants them. Cursed be the hour and cursed be the day when they delivered me unto the school to learn my letters, as though I could live off them. Regardless of how we understand the prodromic question, identifying Ptocho Prodromos with the court poet Theodore Prodromos or not, the same theme appears in many variations in the occasional poems written by Prodromos himself. Learning letters is supposed to make you rich and famous, but in fact it just leaves you with plenty of paper in your pockets and nothing to eat. The question of crowd-pleasing wit, that is, the more performative aspect of being a successful rhetorician, is also addressed, for example, by Nikiforos Vassilakis. In his foreword to a collection of his texts, Vassilakis explained that he had not written many occasional rhetorical works because he was of a scholarly character, scholastikon ethos, and he couldn't stand visiting the houses of the mighty and the rich. He didn't succumb to flattery, nor had he any need for visiting the houses of the mighty and the rich, he said, so apparently he wasn't too poor. Furthermore, he was his own most severe critic of his own text, contrary to most writers, he says, who love their works as monkeys love their children. Similar statements were made by Evstathios of Thessaloniki, who always presented himself as a teacher and intellectual, never as a writer on commission. And yet, keeping up good relations with influential individuals must have been as important for Evstathios as for writers who more openly worked on commission. So the basic problem remained the same. You needed to please your audience in order to make a living and to fulfill your task as a writer rhetorician. A telling statement comes from Konstantin Manassis, or rather from the narrative I in his poem Odiporikon. The poet has been asked to join an imperial embassy to Jerusalem, but he falls ill and has to stay to recover in Cyprus, where he gets stuck for several months. I live here in a land where literature is scarce. I sit here idly, my lips are tied. I'm unemployed, immobile like a prisoner, a rhetorician without a tongue, with no liberty to speak, a rhetorician without a voice, without his exercise. So no voice and no audience, a complete nightmare for a Comnanian orator working on commission. But this quotation also ties in with another concern of the Comnanians, the function and use of ancient literature. At the beginning of the poem, the narrator was safely tucked in, lying in bed, reading a copy of Athenaios. Here in Cyprus, far away from the imperial capital of Constantinople, he's stuck in a place with very little logos, hardly no literature or culture. The Hades of the Timarion, by contrast, is a place filled with both Greek paideia and Byzantine authors. And in this way, it becomes sort of a staging of Byzantine reception of the ancient tradition. Because the Byzantines, especially in the 12th century, did not only recycle previous material, they engaged in a dialogue with ancient authors. I mentioned earlier how Aretas of Caesarea argued with Lucian, or rather insulted him in any possible way. And there are many more examples of both invectives and praises. This communication was indeed described as talking to the dead, as for example in the fatherly advice of Christoforos Zonaras, or Zotros, we're not quite sure about the name. He says, "No one, my dearest son, approaches reading for its own sake, but there is a reason we study the words of the ancient wise ones and do not reject speaking to dead people." So what is the reason? On the one hand, to have one's mind sharp for generating thoughts. On the other, to have one's language well wrought for the expression of thoughts. And this, a very practical attitude, is what marks the relation to the dead and hence many commentaries on ancient authors. Evstathios of Thessaloniki, for instance, produces his enormous Parek Volé on the Homeric epics as a way of showing how useful they are, because you can cut and paste, learn about narrative structure, and produce your own rhetorical texts. Homer will turn you into a successful rhetorician. This method is described in a very literal and rather ghastly manner by Nikolaos Katafloron, professor of rhetoric and teacher of Estacios. In the preface to an oration, Katafloron complains about the rhetors of Constantinople being grave robbers, digging up the dead and stealing their clothes of rhetoric and other embellishments, behaving like vultures fighting among the corpses. And this is not at all a new thing, says Katafloron. This is an old disease of ours, and it's so extensive and itching that it has become a common companion of rhetoric, just like itching accompanies leprosy. And he's right, of course, this is not a new disease. It has a long tradition going back to Roman times and Quintilian's advice for orators in training. This is more or less what Lucian did when he put together his dialogues, along with so many other writers of the second sophistic. It's also characteristic of Byzantine literature, which has often by modern scholars been described in terms of plagiarism, but which in fact takes literary imitation to be an aesthetic ideal. Katafloron, I think, does not argue with literary imitation as such. He's a very self-conscious imitator himself. His concern seems to be rather specific forms of imitation, perhaps unskillful ways of composing cento-like texts. Evstathios voices similar ideas in his Parec Volé, arguing that so-called phrase collectors are mocked due to their lack of rhetorical skill. So imitation is not a problem, but unskillful imitation is. Let us return then to the passage from the Timarion that I cited earlier. Let me tell you, said Theodore to Timarion, in the life above it was verbal dexterity and crowd-pleasing wit that counted. Down here it's all philosophy and true culture with less demagogic display. While Galdelis understands this as a statement against Christianity, Hades being a place where true philosophy can exist without the constraints a Christian society, I read it in light of the situation and attitudes of 12th century intellectuals that we have just looked at. Seen from this perspective, the Hades of the Timarion offers weary rhetoricians a rest from the constraints of their trade, reminiscent rather of the Elysian fields where Homer was placed in Lucian's true story. Moreover, the place itself is constructed by a very practical use of Greek paideia. Bits and pieces from the literary tradition, both motifs and citations, have been carefully put together as to create a Hades that suits a 12th century intellectual. And the fictional space created is not only a reconstruction of an ancient Hades, but includes also the Byzantine literary rhetorical tradition. To mention but one case, Michael Psellosis there, a lisping sophist working as a sort of court secretary, concluding and reciting extempore the verdicts of the court. He's referred to not by name, but as the Byzantine sophist hanging out with ancient philosophers. This way of alluding to the identity of the characters without disclosing their names is another Lucianic device. We may compare, for example, with Lucian's reference at the beginning of the true story to various poets, historians, and philosophers of former times, writers I should mention by name, did I not think their identities would be obvious to you as you read. Not naming the characters thus functions as part of the satire and at the same time as a literary game with the audience, similar to the frequent use of literary allusions in late antique and Byzantine literature. By means of the fictional frame, the Timarion also includes Byzantine space. The narration takes place in Constantinople, and the narrator's journey takes him via Thessaloniki, clearly set in a contemporary Christian time and space, with a festival of Saint Demetrios and references to historical characters, thus representing the present. The journey takes Timarion via this present space all the way to Hades, created by means of the ancient tradition and thus representing the past. Timarion, as an educated Constantinopolitan, may be seen as a link between the two. He moves from the present to the past and back. This is indeed not only a catabasis, but a literary catabasis. We need also to consider the question of the Timarion as a Lucianic satire and the function of satire in 12th century Constantinople. As has been pointed out by Panayotis Roilos and more recently also Przemyslaw Marciniak, Lucianic satire saw revival in the Komnenian period, especially with the works of Theodore Prodromos, who produced a whole series of satirical texts along with the satirical poems and short pieces in prose. There's no time to go into these texts in any detail here, but I would like to point out that practically all these satirical texts are concerned with the problems of learning, and then especially with the problems of people feigning learning in order to gain advantages in society, as in Amathis, the unlearned or the grammarian according to himself, or against an old man with a long beard who believes himself to be wise for this reason, so the feigned philosopher. This theme often overlaps with the topic I mentioned earlier, the problem of learning not making you rich and famous, as expressed by both Prodromos and Ptokoprodromos. For example, in the poem Verses on Lamentation of Learning. So the use of ancient authors is often linked in more or less explicit manners to the Byzantine author's own situation. Comments on ancient literature become meta-literary comments on Byzantine literature and part of authorial self-representation. And Theodore Prodromos is certainly a key figure here with his frequent remarks on learning and use of that same learning in his texts. And I would like to take one of his remarks as a cue for one last consideration of literary catabasis in the 12th century. In a poem praising the deeds of Emperor John Komnenos, Theodore Prodromos regrets that Homer can't be brought back up from Hades to take on the impossible task at hand, and I give you just the reference because the quotation as such is not very interesting. But since Homer can't be brought back, the poet has to try and do his best to praise the emperor, so he has to impersonate Homer himself. Now, as far as we know, contrary to Lucian, Prodromos never wrote a text in which he staged a meeting with Homer in Hades, but he did stage a sort of resurrection of Homer in a paraphrase, or rather a continuation of the Lucianic dialogue Bion Prasis, often referred to as Philosophies for Sale or Sale of Creeds. In the prodromic version, Zeus and Hermes, who are in charge of the sale, pick up where Lucian left us the night before. So everything went really well yesterday with the sale, says Zeus to Hermes, and now we have to sell this other bunch of people. They sort of look like poets, don't you think? I'm paraphrasing, not quoting. So this is a sequel to a late antique work, typical for the practice of appropriation that was so central to the identity of Komnenian authors. It's also significant that they are selling poets, authors, and rhetoricians, not philosophers. What they are selling, in fact, is the literary tradition and the means of mimesis. The first author to be sold is, of course, Homer. It's not an unproblematic sale because Homer speaks only in hexameter and his potential buyer has problems to understand him. Hermes has to use all his persuasive powers to sell the Homeric discourse, arguing for its usefulness in life. And this goes for all the ancient authors that are put up for sale here. They will help the buyers to gain things in society, not the least Hippocrates, who will help you to become a doctor. Aristophanes, on the other hand, doesn't get sold. He scares off the buyers with his foul language. So the Bion Prasis clearly functions as a meta-literary comment on the Byzantine relation to ancient literature. Here they are, our ancient models. Come and get them if you can, or if you can afford them, rather, by getting a teacher who can turn you into a successful writer-rhetorician. And this is the core of literary imitation in Byzantium, to learn how to use in a very practical manner ancient authors. And there's no coincidence, of course, that Homer, the poet, is the first to be put up for sale. In this way, Prodromos does indeed bring Homer back from Hades. The Biomprasis too could be seen as a sort of literary catabasis. There are other texts that could be brought into this discussion, not the least the character studies of Nikephoros Vasilakis, of which two are set in Hades. But it's time to conclude, and so I will briefly summarize my reading of the Timarion as a literary descent to the underworld. A literary catabasis, in the sense that I use the term here, is a textual parody, most often with satirical or ironical functions. It may be compared with Linda Hutchins' useful definition of postmodern parody. She writes that through a double process of installing and ironizing, parody signals how present representations come from past ones and what ideological consequences derive from both continuity and difference. The author of the Timarion, I argue, uses the second sophistic tradition of Lucian in order to discuss contemporary questions of the Greek literary and rhetorical society. This is indicated by three main devices. First, the dialogue form, which carries with it the usages of both Plato and Lucian. It has been modified in the Timarion, I think, with strains of travel fiction, another form going back to Lucian and his true story. Hence the significant movement of the narrator in and beyond time and space. Second, the literary style, which imitates that of Lucian to the extent of sometimes being a sort of Lucianic cento. The style becomes a way of constructing a space in which the author can communicate with his literary past. Third device, the construction of one of the main characters, Theodore of Smyrna. Not only is he the teacher of the protagonist, the person who supposedly taught the author the Greek tradition that he now masters, but in the Hades of Timarion, Theodore also hangs out with orators such as Aristides, one of the most important orators of the second sophistic, frequently cited by Byzantine authors such as Michael Psellos. This becomes yet another link between past and present, maintaining and underlining their differences. So let us return briefly to the West and Boileau's dialogue on novelistic heroes. Of course, Boileau was not familiar with the Byzantine Timarion, so I'm not arguing for a linear tradition here. The common denominator is the Lucianic dialogue, of which the Byzantine Timarion and Boileau's 17th century satire represent two different strands. They were both written in periods when ancient Greek literature held a central position among intellectuals and when strong central powers had the means to control literary production. In spite of some crucial and necessary differences, there are some similarities in the two traditions. One is the appearance of Diogenes, the cynic, playing different roles in different periods, but always, also in the early modern tradition, an emblematic marker of satire. Another similarity in technique is the use of embedded quotations and allusions. In the Timarion, potentially controversial or subversive comments could be embedded in citations from ancient Greeks, expressed in words for which the author was not answerable. At the same time, such allusions would show his belonging to learned circles of the capital, granting him a prominent position. Boileau, in fact, has the same tendency to display his own learning by citing ancient authors, but then probably as a contrast to the unheroic expressions of contemporary novels that he parodies in order to ridicule them. Moreover, both authors use the ancient tradition in order to discuss its function in contemporary society. It may seem to make little sense to take a French 17th century adaptation of Lucian into account when discussing a Byzantine text. After all, there's no proper intertextual relation between the two. But I think that the later reception of a tradition may help us to sharpen our eyes and see things that we wouldn't otherwise have noticed. The same goes for modern literary theory. We are late readers. It's a position we can't escape, so we might as well embrace it. It may also seem a bit old-fashioned to study Byzantine literature through ancient authors, as if we were applying a classical rather than a medieval perspective. But in order to understand the literary practices of Byzantine authors, we need to read what they had read and try to find out how they related to past authors, since the past played such a crucial role in their own production. Combining that with a knowledge of the political, social, and intellectual situation of whatever period we are looking at may hopefully bring us to a reasonable interpretation of the Byzantine texts. I hope to have shown then that the katabasis is a tenacious and versatile motif in the Greek tradition, and that the Timarion is a Lucianic dialogue, though firmly set in the 12th century context. The author composed a textual parody with satirical functions, using the past to ridicule the present. He created a fictional space that both displayed ancient learning and allowed discussions of contemporary culture. And this is significant because communicating with literary authorities is not a small thing, not even in fiction, and especially not in Byzantium. Thank you.